The Splendid Table is listener-supported. If this podcast made your table splendid in 2013, support it as part of your year-end giving. Get a tax deduction and receive a special gift from The Splendid Table. Give at splendidtable.org. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and in honor of the party season, if you haven't done it yet, try the new American gins. Now, they're slick in cocktails, but you can sniff and sip these babies like cognac. And these newbies are inspired by the original Dutch gins from the 1700s. They were done with juniper and botanicals. Now, to taste what they were like, try Ode, as in O-U-D-E, Dutch Geneva gin. And then try our American takes, like Vermont's Bar Hill. It smells like you're walking through a field of wildflowers. Or the snappy, bright one that's called Dorothy Parker. And these are three of many. So stay with us. Lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
It begins with a flash. I know they say it ends the same, but a skill, but a chance. Now every player gets the game. We start with these planets waltzing through the darkness. Tip the axis, that one's ours. Zoom the camera in, cue lights up, dim the stars. We shape the stone, paint our pictures.
Dessa is a singer and songwriter, a rapper and a poet. Now, her reviews say things like, she combines the dry wit of Dorothy Parker and the beat of Mos Def. Or, if she isn't the future of hip-hop, she should be. Well, to achieve all this, Dessa travels constantly with Doomtree, who are her partners in performing. Now, the image of music stars on the road is pretty glamorous. Star chef suppers, special treats. But in the real world, how does an indie rap queen eat on the road? Well, Dessa is here in the studio. Dessa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. What a great introduction. Thanks.
Is food something that you really are into, or is it the fuel that keeps you going?
I think I'm into it. You know, I try to be mindful of daily calorie intake, just because so much of my life is spent kind of stowed in the backseat of a van. You're not moving very much.
Right.
But aside from that singular concern, man, I plan my days, I think, around my next meal.
You perform at night.
Yeah.
Which, you know, a couple hours on stage is like 12 hours of a work day. And then maybe you get some sleep, and then you're on the road heading to the next gig, right?
You know, it's funny. It's like in one way you could conceptualize your work day as like being 2 hours long, the time that you're on stage.
Right.
And in another way, you could consider your work day, you know, as maybe 19 or 20 hours long, because everything you're doing is in the service of performing, even if you're not actually on stage. So usually what'll happen is you wake up, you know, at the crack of 10 a.m.
Right.
And I'll look to my right, and I always share a hotel bed with the president of Doomtree Records. I'm the CEO. His name is Laserbeak. So I say, good morning, Laserbeak. And we go and we brush our teeth, and then everybody hightails it for the tour van, knowing that if we don't get on the road in a timely way, we're likely to miss soundcheck. So you travel for between 5 and 8 hours to your next gig. You get there, you scramble out of the van, you load all the gear in, you check your microphones. If there's time, you scramble away for dinner. And then before long, doors are open. It's time to perform. You do so. You're off stage. You sell T-shirts. You sign some CDs. You get out of the club by about 3 a.m., and you go to the hotel to do it all again.
And in the midst of all that, when do you get a chance to even eat? Never mind, what do you eat?
You know, there's a lot of, like, gas station stops. The food that doesn't come wrapped in foil is the exception, I think, on the road. And so for me, and I do like eating fresh. You know, I really like produce. I'm a pescatarian, you know, so I don't do a lot of, like, gas station hot dogs.
Uh-huh.
And so for me, there is, like, this distant mirage-like oasis of like a sandwich or a salad that I am always thinking about on tour and trying with very limited success to create by, like, you know, collecting lettuce where I find it and getting ranch, you know, dressing that I saw at the last Amoco and stuffing it into the pockets of my jeans. And finally, the members in Doomtree were like, you know, you have maybe half a pound in single serving condiments here. And you got to use some of these before you continue to collect them in the cup holders of the van or in your pocket.
So yeah. What is, when you get a chance to sit down to, you know, a meal, what's joy for you on that plate?
Man, if I can find a sushi spot that stays open late enough for me to run to it after soundcheck and before doors, I am gone. You know, so I use the, like, phone apps like Yelp quite a bit to try, to try to orient myself in cities that I've never visited. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll stop for gas. And I am waiting to take off like a sprinter because I have seen on Yelp that there might be like a grocery store in one block. And okay, if we need $103 worth of gas, like I've got 4 minutes. So if the produce section is near the checkout line, I could get the dream salad. And
yes.
It happens maybe once a tour, you know, that I'll sprint back to the van with, you know, with fresh produce under arm.
Is there singer food? I mean, are there things that help your voice?
I'll say yes, with the caveat that I think a lot of us don't have a really good empirical understanding of why we're doing what we're doing. It almost amounts to superstition. So I've heard that, like, Mariah Carey, you know, before she performs a big night, will always eat the potato chips that she's requested on her rider backstage. But I think that's because Mariah Carey likes potato chips. You know, Mariah Carey will say it's because, oh, you know, there's kind of a fat that's kind of lubricating the vocal cords, you know, to enable a long
performance. I tried that and nobody ever listened. But
yeah. That said, the kind of standard fare that you'll see vocalists trading backstage is, oh, does anybody have fresh cut lemons? If so, everyone will suck on them. Ginger, either kind of finely sliced and chewed on or just steeped in some hot water. Almost everybody uses honey. Everything is aimed towards lubricating the vocal cords.
Does food ever figure into your music?
Oh, that's a first time. There's one lyric about wine and vinegar. Anger is just love left out and gone to vinegar. Yeah, so I guess it was based off the kind of metaphor of wine left too long undrunk. Yeah. And that always fascinated me that there's this, you can kind of imagine a curve upward, sweeping upward like a hill and then falling off like a cliff with wine. That there was this moment when you uncorked it where you didn't know if it was going to have matured into something even better than you had imagined or be totally wasted garbage.
Yeah.
You know, and it felt to me like there was a relationship there with love and anger.
Where do the lyrics come from?
There's a few answers that I've given, but I think the maybe the most honest one is I'm not completely sure. I think sometimes it feels, as I grow older and you've had more bouts of inspiration and more dry spells, it feels more like kind of catching a wave than it does going to a well. So when you feel that a good lyric day is happening to you, it's like, okay, what can I get off my calendar today? Because I don't get these every day. You know?
Yeah.
So it's sort of like you're standing at the place that lightning struck last time, but it's still a game of odds and chance. And there's something that, if it's not mysterious, it's something that I don't understand completely. Sometimes I think it's a little bit of chemicals in my head. You know, there are sometimes when I feel like, oh, this next 3 days, it's not going to be fun to be me, but I'm going to get some great content. And it's not because anything bad happened. It's just you felt like a barometric shift in your brain. I don't know. So a mood shift, I guess.
And you don't know where that comes from.
I don't. I mean, I've tried to figure out what could create the preconditions for that mood swing so that maybe I can go and do that all the time, whether that's staying up too late and drinking too much whiskey. Man, if I can get a great song out of that consistently, count me in, you know. I'll do the hangover. But I guess I haven't been able to find a single variable or a cluster of variables that's reliable enough to bring that on.
Maybe it's the right salad.
Maybe it's the salad. Maybe it's a pocket full of light mayonnaise.
Dessa, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much for the invite.
That old quote came back today. Sitting in my window like a prophet. Out on the fire escape to say anger is just love left out. Gone to vinegar,
You wake up a stranger to yourself, and then you learn to live with a sit in a clothing till you fill out a figure. You know, life's no bella telenovela, the tightrope goes, but you're right in the center. The slideshow, don't put all the pictures together. You try to do it right though, until you let the kite go.
Dessa's most recent CD is Parts of Speech. Now, for more information on Dessa, go to our website, splendidtable.org.
I've been on a good night. I've been on a good night.
One sign of how open we've become to new ideas in nutrition is how restaurants have changed. You want vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free? Well, there's a restaurant for that. Or at least there's a selection of dishes on most menus. Andrew Weil is one of the experts that's influencing these changes. He's a Harvard-trained MD who researched nutrition all over the world, and he tracks and vets the latest nutritional science. His new book is True Food: Seasonal, Sustainable, Simple, Pure. Dr. Weil, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You know, every week we hear different information about what's good for us, what's not good for us. How do you evaluate all of this?
You know, I organize every year an annual conference on nutrition and health for clinicians. And what I have seen is that in the group of nutrition researchers, there's a very high degree of consensus on all the big questions, such as what is an optimum diet, what are good fats, what are bad fats, what are good carbs, what are bad carbs. Somehow that consensus information is not making it into the training of health professionals, and it certainly isn't making it into the media and to the general public. As you say, people think it's totally confused out there and throw up their hands and say you may as well just eat anything. And that's not the way it is. We really know a great deal now about what is good for you, what's not good for you, and how diet correlates with health.
All right. You know what the next question is?
Yeah.
What are they?
Well, if you look around the world, the two traditional diets that have the best correlation with health and longevity are the traditional Japanese diet and the Mediterranean diet. The traditional Japanese diet is not very exportable except to Japanese restaurants. It's very labor-intensive and has a lot of strange ingredients in it. But the Mediterranean diet, I think, is easily adaptable. People like it. The essence of the Mediterranean diet is lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, little meat, except on feast occasions, but plenty of fish, which are sources of omega-3 fatty acids. Mm-hmm. Olive oil is a main fat. Whole grain products, sugar in moderation, red wine, if you like that. That's a diet that's easily appealing to many people. And I'd say here are two areas of great misunderstanding in the public. One is not knowing the difference between a whole grain and a pulverized grain. Products made from powdered grains, from flour, really disturb blood sugar and are a major factor in obesity, in type 2 diabetes. When you eat a whole grain, that's where you actually can see a grain or a big piece of a grain. Digestion of the starch is slow and conversion to blood sugar is slow. If I ask most people in this country to name a whole grain food, they'll say whole wheat bread. Right. Whole wheat bread is not a whole grain food. It's made from flour, and that's very different. The other big misunderstanding I see is not understanding the difference between fruit and fruit juice. Fruit has fiber in it, which blunts the effect of the sugar in it. Fruit juice is a concentrated sugar source. Uh-huh. And the new research coming out on sugar is very concerning. One of the main components of sugars is a compound called fructose, often called fruit sugar, which sounds very innocuous. But the human body can't digest fructose. It disrupts liver metabolism. Table sugar is half fructose. Some sweeteners like agave syrup are much higher, 80% fructose. Mm-hmm. And you want to really minimize consumption of that. And that means trying to cut down on all sweets. If there was one thing that I'd focus on in our culture, it would be sugary drinks. If we could really focus on that and make those go away, that would be a huge advance.
Fats. This is another puzzle. We hear we shouldn't, then we hear we should, then we hear ones that were supposedly not good for us, like coconut fat. Now it's okay. So where does the fat stand, and where does the low-carb, high-carb?
Coconut fat I'm not going to take on, because that's an area of huge controversy, and I don't know the answer to it. I'll wait and see. At the moment, I'm wary about it. But in general, we are still under the spell of the low-fat era that was really dominant in the 1970s and 1980s when people saw fat as the main culprit in the diet. All the new research suggests that fat is not what makes you fat. that we need fat, we need the right kinds of fat, that you can have enough fat in the diet to make food tasty if you're eating the right kinds of it. And the right kinds, olive oil is the best. You want to avoid margarine and artificially hardened fats and things that might have trans fats in them. You know, there's a whole lot of rules about that, but
right.
we should not look at fat as a bad thing. On the other hand, I think the new research suggests that carbohydrates have a huge influence on our weight and metabolism. And the trick here is to eat slower digesting carbohydrates that don't rapidly turn into blood sugar. And that mostly means trying to minimize consumption of products made with flour and sugar.
One other thing that, and this is the thing that I think puzzles a lot of us.
Yep.
What are the clues that can tell us what's right for each of us as individuals?
Very good question, because we are all individual and we're biochemically unique. And I think one of the interesting frontiers of nutritional research is nutrigenomics, that is correlating individual genetics with what we need. And I think soon we're going to be able to map our genes in ways that will guide us towards individual prescription of foods and diets.
I cannot wait for that moment. Dr. Weil, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Andrew Weil is co-author of True Food, Seasonal, Sustainable, Simple, Pure. Now, for a supper in a bowl or a dinner party dish, try his recipe for tofu curry with cauliflower, rice noodles, and cashews. It's vegan and it's gluten-free, and you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. We'll be back with another round of Key 3 with comedian Liz Winstead. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In our Key 3 series, we get into the kitchens of the best cooks we know. It's a masterclass, in a way, because they teach us the three recipes they believe are essential for every cook. Well, our latest Key 3 cook is comedian Liz Winstead. Now, her idea of a great Sunday is to get a bunch of smart, opinionated people together, cook up something delicious but easy, and let the political debates rip. Well, Liz was on the road, as usual, so we got her into my kitchen. Now, you can't talk to this woman without laughing. She co-created The Daily Show. She's won a raft of awards for her stand-up work and for her political satire. Now, I didn't know that she cooked until I got into her autobiography, Liz Free or Die. So I set up some of the ingredients that she asked for, and then she arrived. Liz, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm jumping up and down with joy. You know, to talk about something other than politics and to talk about food is really fun for me.
So we're going to dig into Mario Batali's fettuccine with lemon, hot peppers, and pecorino romano.
We are indeed. I had an off-Broadway show for 2.5 years, and the way to lure these cast members to do something that was pretty intense for free,
yeah,
I said, well, we'll have meetings at my house on Sunday nights. I will make a massive dinner, and we'll go through the script, and we'll rehearse. And so when you have big groups, pasta always seems to come up. And I found this incredible dish. It was easily doubled, tripled, quadrupled. It was sumptuous, velvety. You could make the sauce, keep it on the back burner, until you were ready to toss it in the noodles and heat it up and have it all ready to serve in like 6 minutes.
So where do you want to begin?
You know, I usually chop my onions and my jalapeno first and do my lemons last so that the onion smell on my hands and the jalapeno on my hands, the lemon takes it out.
Smart.
Right? And the key to this dish is you have to have a lot of patience, because with the jalapeno and with the red onion, what makes these flavors meld really well together is getting them really thin. And it's really easy to go, I can't stand cutting this up anymore, but it mm-hmm. has to be mm-hmm. sliver, 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 sliver thin. And of course, with the lemons, we all know the old phrase, when life gives you lemons, you find every cut on your body.
I hadn't thought about that piece,
yes.
But you're right. But okay, this recipe says you want 2 tablespoons or so of olive oil, a medium red onion thinly sliced, and you have the red pepper flakes, jalapeno, etc. So I've got a medium red onion.
It's cut in half, and then it's cut in thin crescents?
Is that it cut in strips, long,
oh, like this?
Strips.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. So if it's from the top to the bottom of the onion. All right. You do the jalapeno.
Okay. So the recipe has jalapeno and red pepper. You can adjust it to your heat liking, because these can be really intense. And just make sure you take the seeds out. And also make sure you wash your hands before you use the restroom. I had a guy help me. Forgot that he had cut a jalapeno, went into my bathroom. I heard a shriek.
You know, you never read this in cookbooks.
No. That's why you have me here. I'm here to help.
Okay. So are you doing more performing or producing at this point?
I just finished a book.
Right.
And so I spent 3 years, well, 1 year doubting I had any skills at writing a book. Then I took 2 years. I actually came back from Brooklyn to Minnesota for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So being back here was really fun, and to reconnect with family in a really profound way. And my dad was this amazing jokester. I'm the youngest of five kids. And when my dad passed away, and it's an essay in the book, he pulled a prank on our family that he had my mom in on. He sent us all cards about 6 months before he died saying, please don't open this until after I'm gone. So, of course, I opened it immediately, and the card said, I love you, you're my favorite, don't tell the others. So, I get the call to fly home when it's evident that my father is going to go, and I get home, and all of my siblings are in the room, and my mom, and we're there as he passes, and we're sitting there, and my mom, you know, still holding his hand. And she said, did your dad send you guys cards? And we're all like, yeah. And she's like, I would love to hear what he wrote. And she goes, and I want you to start, Liz. And I was like, I can't say what it said. And she goes, oh, so you opened it. I thought you weren't supposed to open it. And I was like, yeah, I opened it. I go, you guys open your cards, right? And everyone was like, yeah, we opened it. So she goes, I insist you read it. So he sent all of us the same card that said, I love you, you're my favorite, don't tell the others. Because he knew we would all open it. He knew that we were all egomaniacal enough to think, oh yeah, I kind of was his favorite. And he wanted to have he wanted us to be laughing the first thing. And it was really incredible. So I got the story just where I wanted it, sent it in, tried to take an emotional breath, and my mom went into hospice.
Oh God.
So I had to bring forth, you know, all of that, you know, thing again. So it was crazy. Writing a book is crazy. But all the things around it felt so right for some reason. The fact that I made this decision to come back to Minnesota, I hate to sound all sappy, but it felt meant to be-ish.
Yeah.
You know, it just did.
Yeah.
And so it was great to have that last Christmas here and to just celebrate with her. And so now every year, you know, we all wear one of her Christmas sweaters at Christmas, and you know, those hideous Christmas sweaters that moms have, and my mom had a million of them.
Yeah. I can just see it. Okay, so I've got some water on, and got a lot of salt in it, right?
For your pasta. Always.
Okay, so we're gonna heat up some olive oil in a skillet until it's almost smoking. The onion, the red pepper flakes go in, and they're sauteed until they're translucent, so about 8 to 10 minutes. We're gonna throw in the jalapeno, saute a minute, add the zest and the juice.
Yeah, and here's what I just made the mistake that I want to remind you not to make, is remember you have to have lemon zest. So zest up a lemon before you start cutting.
Yes. So we've got hot pan. Is that hot enough?
We're good to go.
Okay. It sounds like it's bubbling up. We've got all those sliced onions. In they go. In goes now the red pepper flakes.
Yep. We put those
red
in together.
And that's it for the moment, right?
Yeah,
you're going to saute that.
Saute those up.
Ooh, I like that sound.
You did a fine job slicing these onions.
Thank you.
I'm very proud. You did good.
I'm really proud.
Yeah. I will not be talking behind your back.
I'm glad.
Well, you know that sometimes in Minnesota we have something called Minnesota Nice, which can be slightly a passive aggressive way of, you know, saying.
Slightly.
Yeah. My mother was sort of the queen of it. I have a great story about her that sort of sums up Minnesota Nice for me, where I was luckily invited to a speaking seminar series, and the year I did it, Hillary Clinton did it one night, Desmond Tutu, Jonathan Alter, and me. Yes, you're all thinking what I was thinking, me? So I'm in New York, and I get a call from my mom on the phone. And she goes, well, hi. And I was like, hi, Mom. She goes, you know, I'm just looking at the paper, and I see you're doing this lecture thing. You're the only person I've never heard of. And I knew exactly what she meant, but it was like, don't get too ahead of yourself. No one's heard of you.
So, Minnesota nice.
Minnesota.
Yeah.
It's kind of like in the South when they go, bless her heart, which means, wow, I've never met anybody dumber. We need to turn the heat down a little because these are getting a little brown.
I'll take it. Yeah,
you want it to get translucent rather than brown. And then basically what we do is we take our jalapeno and we just throw it in and we just for like a minute or two. You just want to get them kind of soft.
And so you really want to keep them bright and fresh,
you kind of want to keep them bright and fresh, yeah.
We've got a stick here of unsalted Minnesota butter in your honor.
Fabulous.
There you go.
Pasta coming out of water.
Pasta coming out.
Totally drained. Okay. Now, right into the pot?
No. I'm kidding.
Quick.
Yes.
Tell me, girl.
Yeah, the pasta goes right into that.
Dynamite.
And then we toss our cheese in with it.
All right. And this is Pecorino Romano.
Yeah. Boy, does that look good.
Here's a fork. Let's taste.
Perfect.
You tell me.
Oh,
what
let's
you
put
want.
A little salt and pepper on.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Take your pick of salts.
Oh, my
we're
God.
Very fancy.
Sunday, we're going with this.
Okay, this is a coarse sea salt and some black pepper.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Toss that right on there.
Grated. You just tell me when to stop.
Good. Perfect.
Good.
Looks delish.
All right.
Get your fork in here, sister. Make sure you get a little of everything.
Okay. I've got
celebrate.
I've got pepper. I've got onion. Oh, and the butter and that cheese. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, brother.
Whoa, is that good.
Right? Yeah. Just enough heat. And right when you think, is my mouth going to get on fire? It doesn't.
No, it's the butter.
It's so incredible how it works, right?
It is genius.
It is genius.
Liz, this has been fabulous. Thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, so fun. Can we do it again when we don't have anybody taping us and then we can share our secret thoughts?
I would love that.
Okay, good.
I would really love that.
Me too.
Liz Winstead, you are dynamite.
Thanks, Lynn.
Key 3 cook Liz Winstead is the author of Liz Free or Die. Now, check out the website to hear what Liz has to say about her other two Key 3 recipes. Spritz cookies, perfect for cookie swaps, and quick broiled rosemary lamb chops for nights when time's short. Now get those recipes and the one for that pasta she made. It was Mario Batali's fettuccine with lemon, hot peppers, and pecorino romano. Everything is on the website, splendidtable.org. So how about this year? You gift with your own homemade candies. You know, sleek little chocolates and classy sweet bites like the pros make. Well, we've got two candy pros with us, Liz Gutman and Jen King, and they're the minds and the hands behind the Little Bit Sweets online store, and they've written the Little Bit Sweet Candy Cookbook. Jen, Liz, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's talk about candies for gifts. What would be your picks? And I'm thinking there's never enough time, right? So some things that are really easy, maybe two or three things that are really easy.
Well, one of my favorites in the cookbook and one of the easiest is the butter mints. It's really like four ingredients. It takes about 4 minutes to make. It's a great family activity. It's something that little kids can love to do. It's almost like playing with Play-Doh. They package beautifully. You can put them in mason jars or weck jars or put them in little boxes or tins. And it's something that you can flavor a lot. We put a couple different variations, but you could do the classic mint or use coffee or chocolate. You could flavor it with chili or cinnamon. So really, the options are endless.
So, Liz, these are those little mints we often see in bowls at restaurants, but I have a feeling they're probably better than that.
Exactly. The resemblance kind of ends there. And, you know, again, you can color them pastel, pretty whatever your favorite colors are. You know, the holidays are coming up. Color them however you like.
How do you make them?
It's really super easy. It's butter, confectioner's sugar.
A little milk, and then the flavorings.
Exactly. And you mix it together. You knead it a little bit. You stir in whatever colors you like. Roll it out and cut it. Get the kids involved.
Yeah, and it's foolproof. And, you know, depending on the humidity, sometimes more moisture in the air can make it a little bit stickier. So just add a little bit more confectioner's sugar. If it's not coming together soft enough, add a little bit more milk or water. I mean, I would use half teaspoon at a time just because too much and you have to do that. But again, this is a 2-3 minute recipe, and it is something that, you know, little hands can easily do and have a lot of fun.
Well, plus you probably already have the ingredients in your pantry and your fridge. You don't have to go out and buy anything crazy for it.
Okay, what about something chocolate?
Oh, I would go for the Buckeyes. That's an Ohio specialty. It's a creamy peanut butter filling. You roll into balls and dip most of the way in chocolate. We garnish it with a little coarse sea salt because salt makes everything better.
Right.
And also, you know, if you don't like peanut butter or you're sensitive to it or someone else is sensitive to it, you can substitute almost any other nut butter that you'd like. So there's a lot of room for variation there, too.
We even have a vegan option, mm-hmm. too, using coconut oil. So
you dip it in the chocolate, mm-hmm. and that's it. And they're little rounds of chocolate with the top looking like they're
like
golden.
Like a Buckeye.
Exactly. So, and they're really easy and fast.
Super easy. Very similar to the Buttermints in that it's a dump kind of recipe, and you just mix it until it's smooth. Trickiest part is tempering the chocolate. But even in the book, we put a cheater's chocolate, which doesn't require you to temper. It's just melted chocolate with a little oil that will set up.
Okay, so one project candy. But a candy that's going to just blow people away.
I will go with the Dory candy bar. And I know Dory Greenspan, and I love her. But we named this candy bar after her. It's a salted chocolate cookie with a salted caramel ganache with sautéed apricots with lemon and pepper. And it really, we've got such a great reception to it. It's based on, like, Dory Greenspan, but then also sort of idol of mine, Pierre Hermé.
The great French pastry genius, who did
a chocolate and apricot and lemon dessert. So this is something that's unusual enough because of the black pepper and the apricots, but it's a delicious combination, and that's our candy bar. But I know for Liz, and one of the more fun projects is the honeycomb candy.
I do love the honeycomb candy. It's very unique. It's fun to make. It's a little tricky in terms of the temperature, but once you get the hang of it, it's very dramatic. You know, you make
a sugar syrup. What is it?
It's a sugar syrup that you mix a little gelatin and a little baking soda into, and you stir it and pour it out really quickly. It puffs up like a souffle, and it sets like that.
Wow.
So it's full of, it looks like a sponge almost, but it's crispy, but you chew into it. It's got a nice crunchy bite to it, turns a little chewy. It's got a nice honey flavor. And again, you don't like honey, use maple syrup. You know, use whatever you want. Very versatile.
Does chocolate play a role in this?
Oh, absolutely. Well, once you break it into pieces, you have to dip it in chocolate. I mean, you don't have to, but that's the way that we sell it at Litabit Sweets, and that's the way we prefer to snack on it as well.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Liz Gutman and Jen King wrote the Litabit Sweets Candy Cookbook. Now, we've got their recipes for the Dory Bar, Buckeyes, and those super easy butter mints on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, stay with us. We're going to be back with your calls and questions in a moment. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook, check us out on Twitter, or actually send us an email, splendidtable.org. Let's see, who are we going to talk to? Zoe's on the phone from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Zoe, good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Lynn.
So what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fruitcake for Christmas.
A brave soul you are.
I know it.
Okay. Have you ever done one before?
I have not.
Okay. There's going to be recipes out there in the world. You could check our website, splendidtable.org. Epicurious is another good website. You want to be careful of a lot of sites that have a million recipes because you don't know if they've really been tested by professionals to make sure that they're worth your time.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, what kind of fruitcake you want to make? The classic old, you know, style fruitcake?
You know, I'm up for that. I'm up for something maybe a little more modern. Once upon a time, I had great fruitcake.
Do you remember what it was like?
You know, it's been so long. I just know it was good.
To try something that probably no one has tasted on this side of the Atlantic?
Sure.
It's from Italy, and the original recipe goes back to somewhere around the 1600s. Mm. And I think we've got it on the website. It's a recipe from my first book. And in my first book, I wrote a lot about the Renaissance in northern Italy in a particular region. And it is a chocolate fruitcake.
Oh, wow.
It's a chocolate Christmas cake, really, and it's more cake or almost bread than it is fruit. It has candied citron in it.
Okay.
Chunks of chocolate, and it has a thin slick of melted chocolate over the top. It's not wildly sweet, and one recipe makes a couple of small loaves. And they're little domes, you know, they're freehand. And they're great for giving as gifts.
Oh, that's perfect.
Now, it's called, there's two, I can't remember the exact name I've got on the website, but the Italian name is pan pepato. And it means pepper bread. Because the early spice cakes and you know, fruit cakes were usually dried fruits or candied fruits or both with spices in them and often pepper. Because those were some very expensive and very precious things. Mm. People didn't have them, you know, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So they made them at this special time of year. But check out on the website Pan Pepato or Ferrara Christmas Cake or Chocolate Christmas Cake. Yeah. And it's chocolate. It's not super sweet. And it's really lovely. And it has candied citron. And if you want to throw dried apricots into it, dried peaches cut in small pieces, that kind of thing, it would do it no harm whatsoever.
That sounds fantastic.
I think you'll like it. And it's something unusual. People will not have had it. And it's delicious if you have it with a glass of port at the end of the meal or just coffee. But, you know, it's really tasty. So enjoy.
Thank you. I finally got to sit at the grown-ups table last year. I'm almost 40. And I think if you could bring something fantastic, it would secure my spot there for a long time.
I know the feeling very well. I know it very well. Well, Merry Christmas, Zoe.
Thank you. The same to you, Lynn.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We've got Jeff calling from Monterey, California. Hey, Jeff, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. I don't know if you've ever been to Monterey, but it's a foodie paradise.
Oh, I've been to Monterey, and it is a foodie paradise.
Unfortunately, my kitchen is a foodie nightmare.
What's so bad about it?
Okay, so it's one of those kitchens, you know, that's everywhere in California. It's got the tile countertop. The cabinets are okay,
right?
But it's sort of a transitional. It's not a galley kitchen, but it's not an eat-in kitchen. And so I've got about four steps from the prep area next to the sink over to the cooktop. I have another three or four steps to the side to get to the refrigerator.
Right.
And so it's not big enough for a table, but I got a ways to go. And I've done some things like move my knives where I'm using them. I put in a couple of double ovens because I really like to bake and I might want to do something else at the same time. But I'm getting ready to do what I call a kitchen reboot.
Uh-huh.
I want to pull everything out of the drawers and reorganize. So if you can imagine, I have a sink on one side.
Right.
And then the double ovens in one corner and the refrigerator in the other, and then the cooktop in between with the microwave overhead.
Okay.
So I need some advice on how does somebody who really isn't ready for a full kitchen remodel
right.
Can organize things so we can do the mise en place and and have everything right at my fingertips so I can cook like a
Do you have much wall space at all near,
no,
near
I don't.
Your work area?
It was all, when I moved in, I love the kitchen because it's right in the middle of the house.
Right.
But when I moved in, there were cabinets all the way around and absolutely no clearance over the countertops.
Right, right.
So I pulled one wall out, put in a breakfast bar, and now that's sort of my prep area.
Right.
But there's very little wall space. There's a little bit next to one window. Other than that, it's all cabinets.
I was just thinking, one of the things is I love, when you have a limited kitchen, you want a lot of counter space. You know, as much as you can. And
right.
I've put a lot of stuff up on a wall. And granted, it's a narrow wall, as a matter of fact. But I took, and I don't know if this will help or not, but I took small florists' flower containers, you know, those tall metal, almost can-like things with little handles on them that you often see. It could be any container you could imagine. And I have hooked them on the wall with really strong well-anchored hooks. And in there are all of my wooden utensils, all of my metal utensils, and I've got like four or five of them. And they're climbing up the wall. Sometimes I have to reach. Like, I don't use whisks as often as I use wood. So the whisks are at the top. But that's one of the ways I was thinking of going.
Okay, so get the most used tools. And they're spread out over three or four drawers.
All right, they've got to be within reach. The other thing is, really analyze how you like to work, because a lot of times kitchens get us in habits that we really don't like. We're uncomfortable with.
Yeah, them. I'm in a rut. Every time I have to do something, I'm like, I hate this kitchen. I hate this kitchen.
Okay. Now, the next time you do any chore that you do often, start to think about, where would I really like this to be? What would make this easier? And start thinking out every move you make. And then think out, if I had that drawer filled with this, would it be easier? If my knives were in a drawer rack, is that easier? And do you really need to have the plastic wrap in the top drawer? Could it be in the third or fourth drawer down?
I'd love to have it just, you know, right coming out from the wall.
Well, maybe there's a way you could mount it. You could have a dispenser that you mount.
Well, I think this is going to get me through my kitchen reboot and past or up to the point where I get to do my dream remodel. And it'll also teach me how I want to set up the kitchen when I do get to design from scratch.
Exactly, exactly. It's always a work in progress, Jeff.
All right. I love it. And I'm going to go and change my kitchen.
You are dynamite.
All right.
And let us know how it turns out.
I will.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jeff. 800-537-5252. Do you want a cup of coffee that you're going to smile about all day? Well, believe it or not, the place to learn how to do it yourself is Japan. Yeah, Japan. You know, Tea Central. Now, this comes from James Freeman's new book. He has the Blue Bottle Coffee Company in San Francisco. And I think this guy has covered every way to get every nuance out of a coffee bean. The book is The Blue Bottle Craft of Coffee: Growing, Roasting, and Drinking with Recipes. And James Freeman, it's good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Lynn. Thanks.
Now, you think of Japan as being a country of tea. How did coffee become so important?
Well, it started with the Dutch traders bringing coffee in from Java. They brought coffee into the port of Nagasaki. This was when Japan was a very closed society in the mid-1800s. But they were interested in learning about the outside world. They were interested in Western goods. And so that's where it began. And this sort of culture of artisanship and connoisseurship took root. And then the really, it's interesting, it's fascinating to me, the big push was with the Brazilian abolishment of slavery in what I think was 1870. Brazil was targeting Japan as both a consumer of coffee and an exporter of labor.
Huh.
So to this day, Brazil has a very large Japanese population. Japanese people started coming to Brazil to work in the coffee fields in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. And also there was a big importation of coffee into Japan, Brazilian coffee especially.
Now, you talk about in the book a particular coffee house that you go to. And you talk about it as though you were visiting a shrine. Could you talk about that?
Yes, it's Café Hato, Chitai Hato is the full name. It's near the Shibuya station. Shibuya is very frenetic and very Tokyo modern, but this is a few blocks away from the train station, and it's this island of calm. It's perfect. It's not a fashionable cafe. We think of new high-end cafes in the United States as being where fashionable young people go, and it's the very opposite of that. It's been around for about 25 years, and its clientele is you know, older than I am, and it's quiet. It's calm. It's kind of got a grandma-style furniture in it, and it's just such an island of calm where people are willing to take the time to make coffee in what they feel is the most perfect, meticulous way. And it's just so inspiring for me to see somebody take a moment before they even choose the cup that they're going to serve you coffee in. That's a big first step. You know, when you come in, you finally get seated, you know, there's this moment where they're looking at you and they're thinking about what you ordered. And then they look at this wall of cups that's behind them, you know, a couple hundred different China cups. And then, and you can see the wheels turning. It's like, what is the correct cup for this moment, for this customer, for this coffee?
How do they actually make the coffee?
The way that I enjoy in this cafe is called Nil Drip, and that's the English translation of just flannel. It's this old-fashioned way of making coffee. There's a little flannel sack, cotton flannel sack, in a wire hoop. It's about 4 or 5 inches long. Some people call it a sock. I think that's a little indelicate, so I like to call it a sack,
right?
A bag. And so the way the coffee, and it's a lot of coffee, maybe 40 or 50 grams for a 3.5 ounce demi-tasse. And they'll weigh the coffee out. They'll grind it quite coarsely. And then they'll take this swan neck kettle, which is a very delicate kettle, looks like an olive oil cruet with a tight little spout. And they'll manage the grind particle size, the temperature, how they're pouring in this flannel sack is all very much a structured experience. They know exactly what they're doing, and it's the amount of a lot of training and repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll just pour in a very leisurely, methodical way for, you know, anywhere from 5 to 7 minutes.
So really?
It's a very, yes,
huh.
Yes. And it's hypnotic to watch. Clearly, they're concentrating very precisely and very, very fiercely on exactly how they're pouring this water through this hoop. And it's quite hypnotic just to watch, to know that they care so much about it, that they're willing to spend the time to do this technique in what they feel is the best way possible.
And what do you get out of this?
I get just this incredible density. The way they make it is quite a bit of coffee, not much water. The water temperature is quite low, and that's why the coffee doesn't taste burned or over-extracted or harsh.
Uh-huh.
And I get just this incredible density, this sweetness and this velvety thickness. You know, there's a certain kind of thickness that you get from a really, really dark roast.
Right, right.
But it's not that kind of – it's like this beautiful sort of cashmere scarf sort of coffee that the texture is what appeals to me the most because I feel like it's extraordinary. And then as it cools slightly, you get different layers of flavors one upon the other. So every sip is quite different. It's like if you're drinking a very good wine, how it opens up in the cup as you're sipping it, it's a very similar experience.
So, and we can do this at home. I mean, I realize it
yes.
takes practice, but we can – is a Nil expensive?
No, that's the lovely thing. I mean, you can get them if you look on the internet. We sell them on our web store for $26, and it's really quite an easy, cheap way of making incredible coffee.
Time, temperature, ratio, and practice, I gather.
Exactly. A lot of practice.
Uh-huh.
Emphasis on the latter.
James, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
James Freeman is the co-author of The Blue Bottle Craft of Coffee, Growing, Roasting, and Drinking with Recipes. Now, you can find information on the Nil coffee making system and a recipe for roasting carrots on coffee beans. It's by Chef Daniel Patterson. It's called Daniel Patterson's Coffee Roasted Carrots with Chicory Granola. You've got to try this one. Anyway, all of that is on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week.
Thanks for tuning in. And until next week, let me leave you with this definition from Charles Merrill Smith. The cocktail party, a device for paying off obligations to people you don't want to invite to dinner. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything that you heard here today. And don't miss our latest edition of Eating In. It's an ebook. This one is Italian Holidays, and you'll find a full-fledged menu to get you through this season of entertaining. There's a collection of antipasti, pasta, main dishes, and show-stopping desserts. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.